Our next speaker is giving the handouts is Dr. Charles Kange. This session is Synergistic Outcomes Over the Life Course, the Gulf War's Effect on Kuwaiti Health. And Charles investigated this project as a two-time Fulbright Scholar to Kuwait. He works at the Center for Public Health and Human Rights at Johns Hopkins University. Charles.
Welcome. I just want to say it's an honor to be here. It's an honor to present with such esteemed colleagues today. I feel very pleased to be here. Of course, as you know, War and Health is a seminal text for most of us who work in war and health issues. So it's a delight to meet Professors Levy and Seidel here. I just want to say from the outset, my project isn't necessarily focused on peace, but my overarching philosophy and approach to research really is about peace and nonviolence. So I think that'll come through in the presentation itself. Before I begin, I just wanted to give an acknowledgement to the U.S. Fulbright Commission for support of this project, as well as the FLAS program, the U.S. Department of Education, and the Departments of Global Health and the Graduate School, the University of Washington in Seattle, and lastly to the University of Maryland for supporting my travel to the conference. So I don't have any conflict interest. Just wanted to make that clear. My project's basically in three parts, and given our time, I can try to wrap up more quickly. But I wanted to really look at the Gulf War as an event, a major catastrophe. That's the first part. Second part is looking at life course and how the Gulf War fits into a life course framework. And then lastly, looking at the health, public health model, which is, we all probably know, are boxes and arrows. Put together here and kind of talk through what that means. So it's not a data-heavy presentation. In fact, tomorrow I'm going to present more on the results from this project, which is my dissertation, in session 4366, 2:30 tomorrow in room 244. So I wanted to just give a quick synopsis of the Gulf War. The Gulf War actually was really a war between the U.S. and Iraq. Now, when I say the Gulf War, I mean the war in 1990-91. This was a buildup of a real power struggle because, as you may know, we were supporting both Iran and Iraq during the Iran-Iraq War, and we were helping to basically create a monster in Iraq, which, as we see today, is still playing out. We were supporting the Iraqi government to the tune of $5 billion through revolving loan fund, U.S. Department of Agriculture, and those loans were used to buy weapons, right? So Iraq amassed one of the largest chemical and biological weapon arsenal in the world at that time. Well, in 1990, everything came to a head, and the U.S. government had enough of the aggression they felt was coming from Iraq, and so there was a very famous meeting that took place between the U.S. ambassador to Iraq, April Gillespie, and the Iraqi government, in which the Iraqi government felt that they had been given the green light to invade Kuwait. And there was also a backstory between Kuwait and Iraq about oil production and loans and so on, so that was also going on, and Iraq was also kind of fed up with that. And they felt that the Americans had said, this is an Arab-Arab issue, if you wish, we're not going to get involved. Of course, that turned out to be very deceptive and completely false. So fast forward to the Iraq War, the Gulf War, which happened in August 1990, and the Iraqis invaded Kuwait. We waited a while, and then, of course, as you probably remember from the TV at that time, in January 1991, George Bush declared we're going to go to war. So that war started on January 17th. Now, it was a relatively short war. It ended in February 28th. 1991, but what most people don't really consider or think about is that the real environmental disaster started as soon as the war ended. So as Hussein was retreating out of Kuwait, he set all the oil wells on fire, and this led to what many refer to in the popular media as the third worst environmental disaster in the world after Ukraine, the Chernobyl incident, and of course, Bhopal in India. So 700 oil wells on fire, massive amounts of smoke, as Kuwaitis tell me. Being there, it was night. It was what you'd imagine hell to look like. It was just completely dark, even at noon. I wanted to show you a little video about that time. This is taken from British TV.
amen and about.
I just want to fast forward to this part here.
The oil field fires in Kuwait are out, all but one of them, and that should be kept in time for a ceremony tomorrow. It'll mark a great victory for the firefighters. They've done their job much quicker than even they expected. Some of the wells were set alight in the Gulf War fighting, most deliberately ignited by fleeing Iraqi troops. The fires began on February the 22nd. By the end of the war, 640 wells were burning. It was late March before the first fire was out, and it was expected to be next March before all were extinguished.
The war was over in 4 days. The battle for Kuwait's blazing oil wells took 231, but still considered a famous victory for firefighting teams from 27 nations. In the southern field, they were capping the last well today, ready for the celebration when the Emir will symbolically put out the last fire. Especially for the occasion. When Saddam torched Kuwait's oil field, 740 wells were left blazing or spewing oil.
So let's just stop there for the interest of time. I think that gives a good idea of the immensity of the problem and just the how much of a catastrophe it was at that time to deal with this fire, which was the largest, today is the largest fire that's ever occurred on Earth, and took 20,000 firefighters from many different countries to put out. So that's obviously the main kind of exposure that took place in Kuwait and led to health outcomes. The other exposure is depleted uranium, which is slightly controversial, and I'll talk about that a little bit later, but depleted uranium, in a nutshell, is radiologic and also a heavy metal, so it has negative effects on human health. This particular project, though, I was really interested in the interaction between stress and these environmental exposures. So you see the handout here, I have two pathways, and I'll get to that in a second, but the two pathways essentially are looking at trauma and the long-term environmental pollution. Now it's interesting to point out that in Kuwait there has not been a cleanup of the Gulf War to date. There is a fund that's set up by the United Nations Compensation Commission, which holds in escrow $3 billion in a bank in Geneva. However, those monies have not been dispersed for cleanup. There have been other monies that were dispersed for compensation purposes related to health and other infrastructure issues. This is a slide about trauma. So when folks get exposed to trauma, I just wanted to review, and here I'm referring to psychotrauma. Not everyone has not everyone experiences a long-term outcome, right? Most folks bounce back or are resilient. About 85% of folks after typical trauma bounce back, 15% don't, and go on to develop either short-term traumatic stress or long-term post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. So here is the model I developed for this project, and you can see at the top I have armed conflict, which in this case is the Gulf War, the two dual pathways, collective trauma, which is the trauma that's felt at the societal level and affects all the individuals in the society, and in this case, long-term environmental pollution. Now, those are mediated through two types of factors, resiliency factors, which include social support, social cohesion, trust, barriers to exposure, and so on. Vulnerability factors, which includes stressful life events, secondary trauma, and then with this Iraq war, again in 2003, you have a fear of invasion, right? So this is something that's in the back of everyone's mind. A lot of Kuwaitis are very concerned that their country will be invaded again. And then on the left-hand side, you see individual attributes and behaviors. This is genetics and so on. And then also the national policies of Kuwait, including Kuwaiti healthcare. So as I was hinting at earlier, not everyone develops post-traumatic stress, but those folks that do, often it manifests itself in a myriad ways, and those can be quite detrimental to the individual. And then lastly, you have biological alterations. So here we're talking about synergistic effects with the trauma. And lastly, adverse outcomes, which in this case is breast cancer. This is the other model I developed, which is looking at the project through a life course framework and thinking about how individuals are exposed at a certain point in time, and then later in life, after latency period, may or may not develop negative health outcomes. Now, this is based a lot on the work of Bronfenbrenner, right, developmental psychologist, and also Benchlomo and Koo, who are kind of the seminal folks in life course. So if you look at the health pathway at the bottom, you see the individual, perhaps as a child, is exposed during the Gulf War. Then there's a latency period as a young adult. And then early response could be something as a tumor growing as an adult, and then later on they develop the disease. Okay. It's quite intuitive. It's interesting to think about it through the different levels as well, individual, family, community, and then regional. So in the case of Kuwait, of course, tribes are very important, and also play a role in terms of how folks deal with stress or not. Okay. So as part of this project, it was essentially three levels, and I wanted to highlight that in the bottom here. So it's a triangulation of different types of data we're collecting. The first level, of course, are interviews. So I did over 200 interviews with key informants and folks who are involved in environmental health sectors in Kuwait. Meso level is looking at the clinic, so I did a case control study with breast cancer patients and also controls and asked them questions related to their exposures right after the Gulf War until now, and also asked some questions about trauma and stressful life events. And lastly, did an aggregation of the data that are available on cancer and other outcomes in Kuwait, including trauma. So I thought it might be interesting to talk a little bit about the quality of life survey that I did in the hospital. So I would just say, first of all, it's very difficult to get access to Kuwaiti hospitals, and I was doing a lot of work there more as an ethnographer than public health person, but it was very interesting to get inside the hospital, actually work with patients and talk to them, and I would say almost all of them felt there was some type of impact from the war. As Sarah Akbar told me, who led the firefighting team, everyone in Kuwait is marked by the Gulf War. Everybody. So talking to folks, about 95% had come back right after the Gulf War. So that means 95% of the Kuwaitis I talked to were there during the oil well fires. And in this group, we asked questions related to alienation, trauma, and stressful life events. First, I don't have a lot of time left, so I just wanted to quickly give my lessons learned here. So cancer rates obviously increased very highly in Kuwait. They've increased about 250%, which has been corroborated by other researchers as well. And, of course, it's counterfactual, but we assume that that would not have happened if the Gulf War had not occurred. It seems that PTSD symptoms are also indirectly related to the cancer. Cancer rates seems to be an additive effect, whereas if you have both family history and the stressful exposure, you're 10 times more likely to develop cancer than either one of those exposures by themselves, which suggests a synergistic effect. There's also a really strong lack of trust in the government's handling of cancer-related illnesses in Kuwait, so that tends to also exacerbate individuals' stress and possible PTSD. PTSD, I should say this earlier, is around 20% in the Kuwaiti population, which, as you can imagine, is quite high. And lastly, there seems to be a common expectation for additional recognition of the diseases, of the suffering in Kuwait, and also there is a desire to have further compensation beyond the actual health care, but compensation for suffering. So, thank you.
Thank you, Charles. So we have about 20 minutes left for Q&A, and perhaps Emily and Ellen and Geraldine can also come up. I can give up my chair or bring up another one. If there are any other questions for all three of you as well, Patrick as well. Any questions from the floor for any of the panelists? Yeah. Speak up, please, just so...
So the question was if the obesity rates were examined as part of the cancer outcome analysis. So indeed, yes, I looked at all the different confounders that were possibly there, and we found that was not, because it was a case control study, so that was not a factor, that was not a major factor in the increase of cancer rates. Plus, it's important to keep in mind that Kuwait has been an opulent society since the 70s, so a lot of those different lifestyle issues have been there even pre-Gulf War.
Those of you who haven't heard, Amy's question is whether there is a public health association in Afghanistan. These are directed to Afghanistan, and what's the status of the cancer registry and birth defects? Did I capture all of that? Anybody who wants to answer, please come up.
I'll defer to the panelists if what I say is inaccurate. When we were setting up visits to hospitals and that, we didn't come across any Afghan organized efforts. Certainly you had Emergency, you had a couple other international NGOs. There is an Afghan Ministry of Health, and there are public health or projects that would qualify as public health, but I never came across any professional organization. Jerry, you've looked into this? I don't know.
You know, my experience was pretty much the same. It was all internal with Emergency. They did have interaction with the Ministry of Health, but no larger public health structure.
Yeah, please come up if you have anything to add.
The Ministry of Health in Afghanistan does have, they're implementing a very large project called the Basic Health Package, which is essentially primary care within a two-hour walk from your house is their goal. So if you have a health problem, you can walk through the mountains for 2 hours. And in the last, I think it's 6 to 7 years, they've gone from getting that percent of the population to about 80% of the population has access to what they've delineated as basic health, which is very bare-bones primary health care. I'm trying to look up the stats right now. The ratio of general government expenditure on health as a percent of total government expenditure in 2011 was 3.3%. So they're not spending a significant amount of money on this. The percent of private expenditure on health as a percent of the total expenditure is 79%. So, and I think for the basic health package, from when I was reading up on it, they're spending about $40 a person per year is what it rolls out to, if that's a benchmark.
And then very briefly, there has been a big push by the Ministry of Health to train midwives so that they can increase the number of skilled birth attendants, but at this point the numbers are still pretty small.
Any other comments, Charles?
Sure, just to respond to the second part. So the cancer registry in Kuwait is the oldest cancer registry in the Arab world. It's been around since 1972, and it's established, and the data we feel are consistent and quality, at least from 1980. So we were really looking at data from the 80s and comparing it with after latency periods, so it would be late 90s. And that's kind of where I'm getting this 20, 250% increase figure from. Interestingly, Harvard also collected data during the 1990s, and my figures corroborate there. So there seems to be some agreement on that. In terms of birth defects, interestingly, Kuwaitis have noticed, not unlike U.S. veterans who served in, female veterans who served in the Gulf War, that there is an increase in heart birth defects. And so I did present at Teratology 5 years ago about heart birth defects in U.S. military women, and you're seeing the same type of birth defects in terms of missing a part of the heart or being born with a half heart in Kuwait and also in Iraq. So there's this kind of parallel, and we're not sure what the exposure is. I'm not sure if that's related to the chemical exposures, the depleted uranium, which I couldn't get into today, but also an important and interesting exposure point. So there's that.
Yeah, sure. Then I'll call on Greg.
We recently had a visitor from southern Iraq, Basra, an obstetrician who talked a lot about the epidemic of birth defects in Iraq. And one of the differences, of course, for Iraq is that abortion is illegal, so you're going to see all the birth defects. Is abortion legal or illegal in Kuwait?
It's illegal.
Greg, and then. Thanks, Greg. It's nice to hear from Zora in terms of her work with us over the years. Next question.
Yes, hi. I wanted to nod to the public issue like the Minister of Public Health in Afghanistan. I have worked with the Ministry of Afghanistan.
You want to come up here since you're close by?
Yeah.
If you want to.
My name is Taryn Isolki. I'm the Director of Family Health Alliance. We're a nonprofit organization and we work on women's health and rights in the Middle East. For the past 12 years, we've worked in Afghanistan, and because we partnered up with MOPH, I just thought I'd put my two cents into this. The current director, Dr. Saraya Dalil, she is a well-educated, very active woman, one of the best ministers, I believe, in the government right now. And they do have a very active program on all levels. The problem is the not so much having the clinics, but not having the staff, not being able to get women to these clinics because there are a lot of cultural issues, transportation issues, as you can imagine. So the numbers are a bit complicated. So when we talk about a primary health care expansion of 80% access, it's really in reality, it's much less than that because there are many clinics that I have visited as a quality control assistant with the ministry traveling in different regions of Afghanistan. We've been to clinics that they didn't even know how to use an autoclave unit. They had no electricity. We visited one that they were actually cooking a stew inside of an autoclave unit that was shipped from Germany to them. So it's the data is very complicated, especially in societies like this. I would like to give them credit, the Ministry of Public Health in Afghanistan. They have made a major difference in maternal mortality. When we started working there 12 years ago, it was number one, and now is within the number 10. So there is an active, but they don't have resources, as you can imagine. But I would like to ask a question before I sit down. The peace organization that we're talking about, I noticed that they were mainly made up of the Hazara and the Turkmen ethnic group, and I was wondering if they're considering part of their activity to include other ethnic groups, especially the ones that are in conflict with one another, Pashtun, for example.
They are.
That's a, you know, the group originating in Bamiyan, if you know about the location of various ethnic groups, that tends to be a Hazara region. They have reached out and worked with different Pashtuns. At last count, they had three Pashtun men living in their community. They've also tried to open an office in Jalalabad with limited success. But even when you're talking about what this group has done working with foreigners, working across ethnic lines, they've faced considerable threats. They've had their offices firebombed. I'm going to blank on the acronym, not the NIS, and you can jump in here, has seized their computers. And even within the group, there's deep animosity, especially amongst members who've lost relatives at the hands of different individuals from other ethnic groups. So it's a major challenge.
Any other responses from the rest of our Afghani team? Okay. Tom, you had a question?
Yeah. Among the peace-making groups, any useful ideas coming out on how we deal with ISIL that is now running rampage over Syria, others, or just in case we've got to have the military for those kinds of groups?
Comments from any of the peacemakers?
I'll ask for support, but I fielded this question before. And the short answer is I don't have a very direct answer for you. If you look at some of the statements that ISIS has put out, and this is in no means a justification or endorsement of what the atrocities that they've done, especially on the civilian populations in Syria and Iraq. But it's clear that foreign intervention in these lands has driven some of the atrocities that torture and human rights abuses by the Americans and other foreign nations is linked. There was a report put out by the Small Arms Group out of Sweden that tracks weapons, and something like 84% of the weapons that ISIS is using is coming from not only the Americans, but the Saudis, the Emiratis, and other groups, the Europeans. So on the one hand, I'd say one thing is limiting arms flow. It's very well documented that increased arms into regions results in increased violence. I think a peacekeeping operation, similar to what the UN's done in other places, could be a solution, but I don't have an answer directly to your question.
I would only then add, Tom, just having a brief discussion with Noah Gottschalk at the end of the last presentation we had, who was talking about the situation in Syria, which is basically supportive of much of what Patrick is saying, is that the enormous amount of the arms speak for themselves and how that's destabilizing the area. But even if we think about the enormous amount of money that's going into, launch one drone strike, when he was comparing that amount of money for the significant needs, now talking about Syria, of dealing with the refugee community, everything else that's going on, that money from his perspective, and I hope I'm speaking for him accurately, could do so much more for the people than carrying on the war and the continued destabilization that goes on in that. As nice as it seems to want to hit back at those who are being publicized for the beheadings, it's actually very counterproductive in his view in terms of where those resources could get better spent. Next, there's a question over there.
Yeah, I have a question for
I
would again just call your attention to and recommend attendance at the session tomorrow about integrating some of these ideas into the curriculum of public health schools and allied schools as well. There's a whole list of competencies that have been developed, and we're talking now about how to move that forward and get it into schools, into the curriculum. So that would be one suggestion.
And then just one sort of practical from a student level suggestion is at UIC, where Jerry taught and where I went to nursing school, there was joint clubs between the School of Public Health and the School of Nursing and the School of Medicine, and bringing those different perspectives together brought a different light to the issues of public health and how to implement and how to create projects and activities to start to address different issues. I think the Afghan Peace Volunteers offer a really good example of attacking different problems and using those as projects to implement public health and to implement the policy statement. But those would be the two big ones.
Greg, and then you. Greg?
Just to add to where they finished off the ISIS discussion, excellent peacekeeping activities from the American side would be to call attention and to try to stop Saudi funds flowing into ISIS. That would be a good thing to happen.
Thank you, Greg. Louder? So do I. You can come up here. We've already been fixed.
Sorry, I had a head cold. So I want to make a comment about peace, the peace activists and so on. In my experience working with the locals in that region is that it is better if we don't get involved. I believe that when we visit them, I mean, in some capacity, I think it's beneficial, but I believe that when we connect ourselves to one of these peace organizations, because we're Westerners and we are known as Americans, we create enemies. And the feeling is very strong among many groups in Afghanistan that we're talking about for this particular setting. So when they take pictures with us and the group that we're talking about, they're modern, these are modern, young men and women.
They're atypical for the culture.
They're on the more progressive side. They don't represent the conservative society, this youth. So in my experience, what we have tried to do is to encourage them to, and I'm not sure if this is helpful to you at all, but we encourage them to connect with the locals and distance themselves. Not that we recommend it. Many of them actually realize that if they want to get anything done within the country, you need to distance themselves from the foreign entities. This is our personal experience in some of the workshops that we've done, when we have explained that we receive no government funding from the U.S. especially, we've seen in our workshops, it's like pouring water on some sizzling issue. So.
And I'd just like to reinforce that point and provide some context. The Afghan peace volunteers don't receive any funding from foreigners. These individuals aren't paid to do this. In how we were originally connected with them, and in a way it's a story that's embarrassing, is they began Skype calls with individuals in Iran and Gaza and Palestine and India on nonviolence, and they had reached out to this group, Voices for Creative Nonviolence, which was involved in breaking the sanctions and bringing medical supplies to Iraq. It's a 3-time Nobel Peace Prize nominated group, saying, we'd like to invite, and as one of the 35 people who went from around the globe to just learn about nonviolence, to build on what had happened in Bamiyan. And that's how that connection happened. And there has been careful consideration, and having worked on the ground in Syria too, you know, I would reinforce your point that it's a very fine line, and really there's not too much that any foreigner can do to be effective.
I just want to say the part that you said that was embarrassing was that the Afghan peace volunteers reached out to Patrick and a number of other activists and were ignored for about 2 years before Kathy Kelly or Patrick or any of these people were willing to respond
to
them.
It was one of those emails that you sort of think is a scam when you find out you're royalty somewhere saying come to Kabul.
But they were almost literally cold calling people they thought could be of help to them.
Any other comments from the panel on this? Emily? We just have a few more minutes. Amy? Thank you, Amy. You took the words out of my mouth, and I think that's a good way to end our session. I want to thank everybody for coming here, and I want to thank our panelists for giving us a very rich view of their experience and obviously all the contradictions that are associated with that. So thank everyone.